seated. The court is ready to hear argument in 040728, Fairfield Insurance Company versus Stevens Martin Paving, LP.
May I please the court, Mr. David Christian will present argument to the appellant. The appellant has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, I, along with Jess Alexander, represent Fairfield Insurance Company in this matter. The question is very straightforward in terms of a certified question from the Fifth Circuit, whether punitive damages should be insurable in Texas under Texas public policy. After this court decided in 1990...
You think we should look at the defense, duty to defend issue?
Yes, Your Honor, I do. I believe that under the certification procedure from the Fifth Circuit, they had to and did state that they're not attempting to control whether this court decides all the issues in the case or not. I'm not trying to ask just a narrow question. And since only two questions were presented to the Fifth Circuit, duty to defend and duty to indemnify, and since they gave no hint that they wished to reserve any portion of the case to themselves and in fact said that this court's ruling would be dispositive of the entire case, I think a fair reading is that both duty to defend and duty to indemnify should be addressed. Recall that the duty to defend is the most standard duty in the insurance policy, which is a duty to go hire a lawyer, bear the cost of deposition and filing fees, and mount a defense for the company or the individual that's been sued. But the duty to indemnify is quite different and actually means that it's that rare case where a punitive damage award has actually been entered and even affirmed, so to speak, by the trial court under the transportation insurance company versus Morial's criteria and even affirmed by the appellate courts. In fact, that's actually where I'd like to start is by stating that if this court were to rule in the favor of Fairfield, what would the future look like for Texas litigation? Well, I'd love to believe that I was arguing a case was going to affect 99% of the cases, but actually 99% of the cases would not be any different. That is the standard automobile wreck, the standard industrial accident. It's not the claim for punitive damages, even if it's made, that triggers the insurance policy. It's usually the sixth claim or seventh claim in a petition. It's the claims for bodily injury that trigger the insurance policy. And since the duty to defend is triggered, and an insurance company owes a duty to defend, to fully defend the entire case, if even one claim comes within the policy, as soon as the plaintiff sues for bodily injury, then it would, whether it be an industrial accident or a car wreck, the insurance company would still have a duty to defend, even if this court ruled completely in my favor.
So you don't think, it's your experience, that if there were this punitive damage claim in that kind, in a car wreck case, that was clearly not subject to indemnification, and not even subject to the duty to defend, that the insurer would go ahead and defend that claim and not tell the insured, well, there's this claim and you're on your own.
Oh, no. They just couldn't possibly do that under the vast precedent. I mean, King versus Dallas Fire, which this court has held all the way back to the Argonaut case 40 or 50 years ago. This court has consistently held that if even one claim, a claim for bodily injury, a claim for a stubbed toe, triggers the insurance policy, the fact that there might be another claim for an intentional stabbing or for intentional misconduct that would clearly be outside the policy, the insurance company still has a duty to defend.
Isn't there case law from other states that say that if the insurer defends all claims, that if, say, for example, 90% of the judgment is punitive, that then the insurer can seek reimbursement from the insurer for the portion of the defense that's allocatable to the non-punitive element?
Other states do go down that allocation rule, and I represent insurance companies regularly, and I've looked high and low to try and find some Texas precedent that says an insurance company could go down that allocation trail, and I can't find it.
Well, but that's going to be the next case that's going to come up. It's going to be now allocate. I mean, that's a public policy consideration we have to take into account.
It is a consideration, Your Honor. I agree. But since cases are defended every day where there is one claim that's not covered, for example, there'll be a claim... trying to think of just something so standard, there'll be a claim against an employer that they negligently hired somebody and that employee beat them up. So there's a claim and they allege you know, you intended to assault me, you negligently hired this employee. There's a vast array of claims. And since insurance companies regularly defend whole lawsuits, even where one claim is not covered or two claims are not covered, they simply do it under reservation of rights. And they've never, in Texas, been able to come back and allocate between covered and uncovered claims.
They've never known. That's not been
resolved. That's true. That question has not been resolved. That's true, Justice O'Neill. It's never been resolved.
Is there no dispute that, but for your public policy argument, that the insurance policy would cover punitive damages? In other words, there's no exclusion for gross negligence, no exclusion for punitive damages in the contract?
Justice Wainwright, I'm tempted to say yes, but that's not quite right because the policy just really doesn't specifically speak to the issue. It doesn't say punitive damages are covered. It doesn't say punitive damages are excluded. And when courts say we want to look at simply the meaning of the policy, which is in the Milligan and the Schaefer cases where the courts were looking at what does this policy mean, an uninsured motorist policy, and the language has virtually the same language as our policy. They said this policy language does not cover punitive damages. But there, you can tell by reading it that they're reading the policy language in light of what they believe Texas public policy is.
In light of statutes.
Yes, the statutes.
And there's no statute at issue here.
Your Honor, there is no statute at issue here. That's correct.
Are there any constitutional issues raised here? Right to contract, for instance?
Well, I mean, certainly the appellees have argued the freedom of contract. And freedom of contract is a right not only recognized by common law, but by the Constitution, defends certain freedom of contract. The reason we don't believe that that issue is present here is that a workers' compensation policy is not written by the insurance company nor negotiated. It's a standard form that Texas says you either operate under this policy or not. And Texas insurance companies are now looking to see whether they're going to have to pay for punitive damages under this policy wording because...
Policy wording, Part 2, Employer's Liability Insurance, Subsection C, does specifically exclude from indemnity because of bodily injury... exclude punitive damages specifically from because of bodily injury to an employee employed in violation of the law. So by specifically excluding in that instance, doesn't that mean that it is, in effect, covered?
Well, Your Honor, that may be a correct reading of the language in the policy.
And I will let you answer that, but if that is a correct reading and if, in fact, it is covered, what about the fact that premiums have been paid based upon the expectation of coverage?
Well, that's a good question, Your Honor. The main thing I would point out is that Fairfield's position has been from the beginning that it's arguing public policy. So it has attempted, rightly or wrongly, I'm just trying to be candid with the court, Fairfield has taken the position that it's an overriding public policy consideration. So it's not been arguing in the lower courts, this is what our policy means or doesn't mean. It's been arguing public policy.
I understand, but
your question about, now, have you collected premiums to cover punitive damages, and now you're not going to cover them? And, Your Honor, all I can say is, since 1998, the seemed-to-be-controlling case stated that punitive damages weren't insurable in Texas. That is, after this court spoke in Transportation Insurance Company versus Morial, there was a dearth of direction, except for a very cogent opinion written by Judge McBride, which analyzed Texas law extensively.
Insurance companies did not lower their rates in response to Morial.
Your Honor, I don't know that insurance companies lowered their rates in response to Morial or not. I couldn't speak to that issue. It's certainly not in the record in this case.
But the form of the state insurance contracts could be changed. If we were to hold that they are covered or can be covered, the parties can agree or to cover them or not, then the Board of Insurance could draft two alternatives for that, could they not?
They could. If this court were to hold that Texas public policy prohibits the insurance of punitive damages, I guess since technically the Department of Insurance is, so to speak, an arm of the legislature, it would be a question of whether the legislature or the courts should have the last word on this issue. And I don't think anybody
in
this...
No, I was the
other
way around. You were saying, well, but you know, we we're stuck with these policies, you know, the policy, but the policies aren't written in stone. They can be changed.
Yes.
The process would do that.
Yes, sir. They're not written in stone, but they do rarely change. I mean, I think, I can't remember the year, but I want to say we've been operating under the same worded policy for about 8 years, and it's almost identical to the policy that preceded that for about 10 years. I mean, they do change every once in a while, but it's pretty rare. But the main legislative directive that we would like to remember is that the legislature has stated that juries are specifically supposed to award punitive damages based upon the net worth of the defendant. Now, keep in mind, the legislature was following this court's lead. This court has always considered that it governed punitive damages because, after all, punitive damages are a child of the courts. I mean, the courts created them and have governed them, and in Transportation Insurance Company versus Morial, this court spoke first. Then the legislature agreed and said, virtually statutorily enacted Morial, and said, consider the net worth of the defendant. So here's what would happen if y'all ruled, if the court ruled that punitive damages were insurable. A jury would be arguing a fiction. It would be a delusional exercise where counsel say, this poor mom-and-pop operation has $100,000 worth of net worth, and so only hit them for a fraction of that net worth, even though they may have done something like intentionally, or I should say knowingly, exposed a worker to a very dangerous product like benzene or something like this, and caused one worker to get sick and replace them with another worker. They could engage in heinous conduct, but the jury says, oh, we're only going to award them, say, $50,000 because this net worth of this defendant really isn't that large. It's a delusional exercise if they actually have a $300,000 or $1 million policy. Now, we submit that any time this court does something that renders an act of the legislature to be a delusional exercise of the jury, where they're literally deliberating over something that has nothing to do with where punitive damages will ultimately be paid or who will truly be punished. Because the question is to punish the defendant. And so the jury believes they're punishing the defendant and argues about the net worth of the defendant. The net worth of the defendant is completely irrelevant if punitive damages are insurable.
That sounds close to a suggestion that we leave this issue to the legislature. Is that where you're headed?
No, Your Honor. What I'm saying is the legislature has already spoken. That's my argument. And perhaps I wasn't clear, but what I'm arguing is that the Texas legislature has already spoken and said, since the jury should consider the net worth of the defendant, and since that would just be eclipsed by insuring punitive damages.
Well, of course, all insurance does that to some degree.
Yes.
I mean, the idea is, in a tort case, to shift the cost to the person that caused it. But we're not really shifting the cost to the person that caused it if they have liability insurance.
That's true. But where you're talking about compensatory damages, where the goal is to compensate the plaintiff, if our goal is to punish the defendant, I really don't know how anybody can say with a straight face, we want to punish this defendant. But it's okay if he's not really punished.
The argument's been made that it's significant punishment to have policy erosion, loss of insurance, higher premiums. And for your argument to succeed, we've got to sort of equate gross negligence with intentional conduct.
I'm not sure I follow that last part, Your Honor,
you're presuming that the punishment is for something the company has done intentionally, when in fact gross negligence is something short of intentional conduct. And if it's short of intentional conduct, why isn't higher premiums or the threat of loss of insurance sufficient deterrence in that context?
Your Honor, we believe that gross negligence is so close to intentional misconduct now, it's actually easier in Texas to convict somebody of criminally negligent homicide than it is to get a gross negligence finding and punitive damages in a civil case. So it is so close to intentional misconduct, it means that you know that this is a very dangerous situation, such as a very dangerous product. You subjectively appreciate it, you still just decide to go ahead and expose somebody to that. And so it's the rare case we're talking about where somebody would be hit with punitive damages and not be able to pass it on to their insurance company. It's the very rare case where both the jury and the court have decided to punish somebody. And it's that rare case that we're submitting this court should not bless insurance coverage and it should pronounce a public policy. We do not believe that this court should wait for the legislature to speak. After all, after Hartford versus Powell in 1998, when the prevailing opinion in the state, I mean, the main dispositive opinion in terms of a thorough analysis of Texas law said that punitive damages were not insurable, there was no movement in the legislature to say, oh, this federal judge got Texas law wrong, or we need to pass a statute in favor of it. The Texas legislature stood by and said, well, Justice McBride freely talks about the fact that punitive damages are to punish somebody in reference to their net worth. That seems consistent with not insuring punitive damages.
You say the legislature has spoken. Amicus raised the point that the legislature has, in at least two specific instances, once allowing insurability of punitive damages and once precluding insurability of punitive damages, on specific instances in the medical liability area.
Yes, Your Honor,
and they point to that as an indication that the legislature wanted to preclude insurability of punitive damages across the board. It could have, but did not. So they suggest the legislature has spoken in a different fashion. How does that change your argument?
With the court's permission, can I reallocate, say, 2 minutes of my time?
Chief?
You may.
Thank you, Your Honor. I believe it's a very good question because it is the one time the legislature has spoken. It is in a very narrow area of medical liability, lawsuits against doctors. This state treats doctors differently legally and should. I say that not only because I have a family of doctors back here, but also because throughout Texas procedure and Texas substantive law, we want to protect doctors from any liability as best we can to keep doctors practicing in Texas. And it was in that very narrow area where they stated, where they specifically addressed the situation. And I think since we treat them different procedurally, you have to have a different mechanism to sue a doctor. I believe that that should not be read as a public policy to the state as a whole. Instead, we should turn to the legislation that speaks to punitive damages as a whole, where they say that the net worth of the defendant should be a dominant consideration.
Except that one of the statutes precludes providing insurance for physicians and healthcare providers. So that runs counter to your argument that doctors are protected generally.
Your Honor, if I remember the statute correctly, they wanted to allow a larger group, such as corporations and healthcare providers, as corporations, they address that as allowing insurability or allowing punitive damages or prohibiting insurance. But when they address the specific doctor, the specific physician, in a subpart of the Texas Insurance Code, that's where they said the insurance commission can adopt a form that does cover punitive damages for a doctor. And the Texas Insurance Commission approved one form. It was never used, so it's kind of a non-issue.
That was in one provision. In another provision, it just precludes insurance coverage for punitive damages assessed against a physician or healthcare provider when that insurance is offered by the Texas Medical Liability Insurance Underwriting Association. So in one instance, they did allow it. In another instance, they precluded insuring punitive damages as to medical liability type cases for certain healthcare providers. But you think the area of doctors and healthcare is different in Texas and it shouldn't be generalized. At least that's your position.
Yes, Your Honor, that's my position. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the appellee.
May I excuse the court, Mr. Charlie Self and Mr. Mike Cooper will present argument to the appellee. Mr. Self will open with the first 10 minutes.
Ladies and gentlemen, the court, counsel. I'm almost afraid to start off my argument by saying this is a simple issue, but it is a pretty much of a straightforward issue, at least as we've seen it, and that is by allowing an insurance policy such as the policy that we have in place here to cover punitive damages, is my client going to be punished? There's been a reliance in this case back through earlier arguments, not necessarily before this court, on a case we've referred to as McNulty, Northwestern National Casualty versus McNulty, which seemed to go against allowing punitive damages to be covered by insurance because the punishment would be not, the wrongdoer wouldn't necessarily be punished. It would be passed on to someone else. And that was followed through all the way through Transportation Insurance Company versus Morial, which spoke to punishing the wrongdoer, deterring future conduct, and finding, as Morial said, an appropriate level of punishment. The Austin Court of Appeals, I believe, in Safeway Steel discussed this and went through some of the things that kind of worked against the argument that if an insurance company paid these damages, the wrongdoer would be punished. And some of those have already been touched on, such as the fact that insurance premiums will rise. The inability to obtain an insurance policy. Other factors such as that. My client, Stevens Martin Paving, is a perfect example of how whether or not they pay these punitive damages or the insurance company pays these punitive damages, if in fact any are awarded, they're going to be punished. Stevens Martin Paving.
Surely it wouldn't be quite the same, is it? I mean, a figure of the punitive damages is awarded, some number, and you either have to write a check for that or pay additional premiums, but they're not going to be the same number, are they, or do you think they will be?
I think eventually they will be, yes, Your Honor.
I thought the point of insurance was for all of us to get together and me to help pay for your accidents and you to help pay for mine.
Yes, sir, I believe that it is, but I think that my client will end up paying the substantial, if not all, of that. My client is a, as I said, a contract paving company. About all the work they do is a public bid. They show up in Austin or Taylor County or wherever they are to bid on doing County Road 155, and they hope they get that bid. When they make that bid, one of the things they're required to show is we have insurance. We have insurance to cover everything. This is not a situation where Bob's manufacturing company gets hit with higher premiums for its comp and decides, you know what, we're going to go without comp this year. We're going to take the chance. We can't do that. We can't try to go a year without having this insurance, so we're going to be punished. In addition, there was discussion, I believe, in McNulty or the Safeway case that, well, eventually this cost is going to be passed on to our customers. That would be true, for example, in a manufacturing situation. We're not even in the position where we're going to be allowed to do that. Our insurance premiums are going to go up if we get hit with punitive damages. Truth be told, our insurance premiums are probably going to go up because we're all here. But we can't pass that on. We're not going to be allowed to pass that on to the state of Texas or Taylor County or Travis County, because if we try doing that, we won't have the work.
Let me ask you about the appellant's brief says you took a different position below.
Yes, sir, I did. I took a different position. I'm sorry, I keep knocking this glass around. I apologize to the court. I did take a different position because when I first got into this case, when I first reviewed Morial, I thought that, yes, it's probably correct. Public policy doesn't allow for coverage of punitive damages. I think I surely misstated the law, because as we're all here, or we've been to the Fifth Circuit, now we're here, I don't know what the law is. Like I said, I kind of was fearful of saying this is a simple question. It's not a simple question. I don't mean it that way. My point is it's either a, are we going to be punished or are we not going to be punished? I think it's overwhelming that we're going to be punished. And if that's what we're basing this on.
Well, then answer the question about, you know, when you're arguing to the jury, one of the factors you consider is the defendant's net worth. And so, you know, a defendant will be arguing the net worth is low, maybe it's non-existent, but not informing the jury of the insurance coverage.
I'm not sure that I would have an adequate argument how to address that. I don't know that you could walk in and say our net worth is zero or our net worth is $10,000. There's lots of different ways to play with
net worth. Are your premiums for punitive damages going to be based on somehow on your net worth?
I would think you would have to, yes, ma'am. I'm certainly not trying to stand up here and speak for the insurance industry. Don't misunderstand. But I would think if the court rules that, yes, this policy or these type of policies cover punitive damages, then when the insurance company goes and does their underwriting or whatever they go through to do this, they're going to have to probably take a look at that. Because if the jury is going to look at, if the only thing the jury is going to be allowed to look at is the net worth, and base their decision for punitive damages on that, then yes, they're going to, the underwriting is going to have to take that into account.
Is there any indication that currently underwriting takes that into account?
I don't know. I'm sorry.
But doesn't all of this sort of sound like, we did accept the question and we'll resolve this case, I suppose, but doesn't this sound like something the legislature ought to be deciding in committee hearings? You know, what impact would there be on premiums if the public policy of this state were to insure for punitive damages? How do you, what are the actuarial tables? Should we revise or, write a statute on the questions that go to a jury in terms of networks? I mean, doesn't that sound like a more of a legislative process?
I would agree with you, yes, Your Honor, because I'm standing up here now speculating as to facts as to what an insurance company may or may not do, and probably a legislature or a legislative committee is much better equipped to handle that question.
Have you raised any constitutional issues in this court?
No, sir. I don't believe I have.
Well, we can't certify the question to the legislature. What do we
do? Your Honor, what do y'all do? I guess just what I'd like you to do. Hold that this policy would cover punitive damages. And I'm basing that on the, as I've said earlier, the charge, for lack of a better term, for Moriel to make sure they're punished. Make sure that happens. Deter this future conduct. And if the insurance company pays this, I can assure you, my client sitting back there is going to be punished. He may not necessarily be punished that day, but he eventually is going to be punished, and probably for a lot longer period of time.
And with respect to a question asked earlier, what should we tell the jury? You don't think we should tell the jury that there's insurance that covers punitive damages of so much or so little?
I would agree, Your Honor, because from what experience I've had trying cases, if a jury ever finds out there's an insurance policy there, everybody's thinking seems to change.
Don't juries generally presume that the parties are covered by insurance? They don't know, but don't they generally presume that?
I may get in trouble saying this. That might depend on what county you're in, Your Honor. There's a reporter in here. I hope he hadn't quote me on that. Thank you. I'm going to reserve the balance of my time, Mr. Cooper, and shut up before I get in more trouble.
May it please the court, federal counsel.
You're on the same side of this case with Mr. Sapp.
I'm on the same side, a little different. I would like to answer your question first. The question of writing a check. Isn't that greater punishment, I seem to think your question was, than if he had to pay greater insurance premiums or couldn't get insurance? I'm not sure it is, Your Honor, because of this. The effect of having to pay greater insurance premiums in the future as a result of having a punitive damage claim judgment against you is an effect that goes right to the bottom line for years to come. It affects a person's or a company's profits from years to come. And it's something that he will continue to feel for a long time, as opposed to simply sitting down and writing a check that affects 1 year.
No, I guess what I was wondering is, you assume that in the insurance business, there's 100 insureds and 99 of them never have a punitive damage claim, and one of them does, and the loss is somehow paid by all of the insured's premiums. Maybe not entirely, but that's the point of insurance, is to allocate it out over a larger number of people. And so I wondered whether just writing a cold check for that money, as opposed to having it shared by the premium generation process in the insurance business, would be different. But I take your point that it could be made up over time.
Yes. The other thing is that I would point out to this court to that I think is important here in deciding this public policy issue is this. This is a summary judgment case that came down as a result of a declaratory judgment filed by the insurance company. A declaratory judgment, I mean a summary judgment motion that was filed shortly after the declaratory judgment action was filed. There is no record by which one can look at these issues we're talking about and determine really what the effect of insurance premiums is, of greater premiums, whether you get insurance premiums, how that would be passed off. And I do think that if you look at the history of Texas as it has dealt with punitive damage issues, that by and large it has left that to the legislature. Because that can be developed through hearings and on a certified record and so forth. And I think that is one of the problems, and that's why I think to simply rule that because an insurance policy may insure and indemnify against an award of punitive damages, that there's no punishment is too simplistic approach to the issue. When I briefed this case for Judge Cummings in the district court, I felt that the judge in Fort Worth in the Powell case was wrong, because I looked at his case, and as I looked at that case, and as I look at a lot of these cases that have come down on the part of holding that punitive damages are against public policy, a lot of them rely greatly on the uninsured motorist cases. And the uninsured motorist cases are a totally different animal, because there, Your Honors, you are asking the victim's insurance policy to pay the punitive damage claim as opposed to the tortfeasor's insurance policy. And there are all kinds of reasons not to do that apart from the public policy issues. So these cases that I've seen rely heavily on that, and I think that is wrong. Another aspect of this case that from my aspect that I would point out to the court, I represent a widow and three small children in a claim that in which workman's compensation was involved. That's why I'm here under the labor code. On a punitive damage issue, because that is the only claim that she has other than the claims that were brought, the payments that she got from the workman's compensation.
And as a result, a lot of cases that wouldn't allege punitive damages, when they're asserted against an employer, there's a greater tendency to plead punitive damages for just that reason.
Yeah, well, the only pleading you've got.
And so, if you want to be insured against that, the only way to do that, because the workers' comp bar encourages people to do that in workers' comp cases if they want something more than the monthly and the weekly
That's
wage.
That's correct,
John. But so, argument is we're really turning what would otherwise be a compensation claim into a punitive damages claim. How come you can cover that if it's outside workers' comp, but you can't cover it inside workers' comp?
I don't know the answer to that. All I can say is this, is that generally, in particularly in the kind of case I got, the type of economic damages that my client could prospectively have recovered in this case, were there not workman's compensation, are much greater than the amount of economic damages that she will recover as a result of the workman's compensation statute.
But my point is, when a jury is deciding whether to stack money into mental anguish or stacking into punitive damages, they've got a lot of leeway.
That's true.
And they'll be guided by hints, perhaps, from the trial attorney to say, we're not asking for that much mental anguish this time. We want a lot of punitive damages, or the other way around. Why should one be covered by insurance, one not, and the other not, when there's so much leeway for the jury to just swap the money back or forth?
I'm not saying that one should be covered by insurance and one not. I'm not arguing that in automobile accident cases, for example, that punitive damages shouldn't be covered by insurance there. I don't think the public policy arguments are any different. I don't see a reason that if an employer if a tortfeasor is willing to pay the premiums to cover punitive damages, and an insurance company is willing to write that, I see no reason why that shouldn't be honored.
That's the question, though. You say willing to write it. If the law's been unsettled, we don't know if they've been willing to write it or not currently, do we?
I know of no other than in the case of the health providers. I know no statute that prevents an insurance company from insuring against punitive damages if they're willing to do it.
Should some states, it looks like, have drawn a distinction between intentional torts and, I guess, gross negligence? I mean, should we say it's all right to intentionally stab someone or sexually assault them and say that they can, at the back of their mind, say, well, I don't care, I'm insured?
Well, Your Honor, I think I would, I think I might agree with that. I think there is a difference between an intentional tort, where somebody intentionally says, I'm going to go up and bash this guy over the head, and I'm going to do it because I don't have to worry about it. And the type of showing you have to make to recover punitive damages under the Civil Practice and Remedies Code in this state. I think there's a big difference there.
Well, these policies uniformly have intentional conduct exclusions, don't they?
Yes, they do. But I think that's a big step to go from intentional tort to what the definition of malice, which governs my case, under the Civil Practice and Remedies Code.
And under that rationale, then you would allow insurability of conduct that satisfies the criminal negligence definition in Texas?
When you say criminal negligence, you're talking about a criminal statute then. And I think that's different. I think there's a difference between insuring for criminal acts and for civil acts. Criminal negligence, there's all kinds of other issues involved there. For example, a person charged with criminal negligence, he's either got to go through the indictment process or he's got to go through the complaint process if it were a misdemeanor. There's constitutional issues there, and there's also issues that the burden of proof to prove that is significantly different. The burden of proof, I think there's a significant difference beyond proving a criminal case beyond a reasonable doubt and the clear and convincing evidence standard that would apply in this case.
Well, let me ask you about something else. The U.S. Supreme Court has said in its State Farm case that we need to, as a matter of due process, review the ratio between punitive and actual damages. What would be the actual damages, since you're going to trial, you hope, only on punitive damages, gross negligence here? What would be the actual damages? Would you add up all the workers' comp indemnity payments? What would be the actual damages in your case?
Incidentally, there is a case, and I forget the site of that, that in the Court of Appeals right now that has to do with governing whether the $200,000 limitation in the Civil Practice and Remedies Code would apply in a case like this. And there's some question that you would be entitled, even though you're not, you can't recover economic damages as such or actual damages, that you would be entitled to put on evidence of what those would be for determining the formula under the Civil Practice and Remedies Code to determine whether it exceeded $200,000. In this case, probably the economic damages you would be looking at would be the value of what the plaintiffs would receive under the Workmen's Compensation Act. And that may be the numbers you would put in under that formula to determine that. But that kind of goes to, I don't see an inconsistency, for example, considering the net worth of the employer in arriving at punitive damages in a case like this. The consideration of net worth standard is there to give some substance to how you figure punitive damages so that juries just aren't speculating on it, to give some substance to it. And obviously, I don't think that you would give that substance by telling them there's an insurance policy, because that would absolutely invite them to speculate.
Thank you, Counselor. Are there any further questions? Thank you.
May it please the Court. In my limited time, I'd like to specifically address the question raised by Justice Wainwright when he said the United States Supreme Court asked them to look at a ratio. Thank goodness the United States Supreme Court did not say, well, this is a controversial area. We'll just let Congress decide about this issue, and we'll just wait for Congress to act about punitive damages. Likewise, several years ago, the United States Supreme Court said there must be procedural due process limitations on punitive damages. Thank goodness they didn't say, this is a controversial area, we'll defer to Congress. And when this court spoke in Transportation Insurance Company versus Morial and said punitive damages are out of line and they're meant to punish, thank goodness this court did not defer and say, why don't we just leave this question open and allow the legislature to speak. Punitive damages are the creations of the courts, and the courts should govern them. That's my abstract argument. I would like to address a very specific argument that you raised, Justice Brister, about a business that wants to protect itself. If this court finds that a duty to defend still exists, which is an alternative argument we make, the average business would still be protected from a lawsuit. They would only not be protected from a final conclusion at the end of an entire appellate process.
Right, but my question was, you don't disagree. A jury has a lot of leeway whether to put the extra zeros into the compensatory damages or the punitive damages.
Your Honor, actually, I do disagree. While the jury can move those numbers around.
I wrote an opinion in Schindler Elevator where the jury awarded $11 million in actual damages and $100,000 in punitive damages. And when that newspapers asked them after trial, why'd you do so low? They said, well, we put all the punitives in the compensatory. We didn't know there was going to be another part of the trial. No question jurors do that.
I really misspoke. There's no doubt that jurors do that.
But why should one be insurable and the other not?
Because through the appellate process, the punitive damage award is very likely to be eliminated because of the law, the harsh strictures, and because of the bifurcation of the trial procedure where you have mental language damages awarded and they only get to the separate trial on punitive damages if there's first a gross negligence finding. I think that keeps the shift from occurring. Thank you.
Let me ask you, in a settlement, $2 million, whether you do or don't cover punitive damages, you don't divide that out when you settle the case.
That's correct.
So probably some insurance companies right now are settling for a little higher because there's an aspect of potential punitive damages, that the plaintiff's demanding more.
That's correct.
So probably today, already, insurance companies are paying, in part, punitive damages.
That's correct. And if this court were to find a duty to defend, it's likely that they would sometimes cut checks to get rid of nuisance cases so they wouldn't have to defend.
Counsel, do you see a distinction with respect to this case between intentional and grossly negligent conduct, or is your position entirely positioned on punitive damages having a public purpose of deterring and punishing, irrespective of the conduct that led to the award of punitives?
I do believe that there is a difference between an intentional act and a grossly negligent act, but the difference is so small that in Transportation versus Morial, this court stated that punitive damages are quasi-criminal in nature. That is, they're punishing quasi-criminal conduct, so that space is very, very thin.
But it is there.
It is there.
I mean, you've got an intentional exclusion. And so to rule your way, we have to say that really, in effect, it's criminal. There would take out the quasi piece.
Well.
Effective.
No, Your Honor, I think to say that it's quasi-criminal, I think all this court needs to say is when we said that these damages are meant to punish a defendant, we really meant it. We really meant it's to punish a defendant, not to make everybody's insurance premiums go up. The people that are completely innocent but want to say, why did my premiums go up? Thank you.
Thank you, Counselor. That concludes oral arguments for today. And the Marshal.